Accession number 210026, reel 3.
Les Bryan, reel 3. You were just telling me what the last man in the patrol...
Yes, the last man in the patrol, his job was to guard the rear of the column, to look out for any ambushes. And we were passing the cemetery gates on our left when suddenly four Germans came through the gates. I threw a grenade. I shouted, "Grenade, Germans, and next thing on you." Like we'd been trained, one of the soldiers in the patrol, he cupped his hands. It was like a step. My right foot went onto his hands and over the wall. Now it was about 8 foot this side of the wall, but what I didn't know was on the other side it was about 15 foot. So it was, I fell rather awkwardly on a slopy piece of ground, which stunned me. But next thing I knew, there was five of us in this particular piece of ground, and it was nothing but tombstones. It was a cemetery. And my first thought was, am I going to die here? No, I'm not going to die. And there was just a little window at the edge of this building. And, of course, I looked to that and I thought, well, any German from there, he could pick us up. So I told the rest of the boys to keep behind their tombstone and just stay put. The Germans had made it very clear they wanted us because they'd put a ladder on the other side, on the other wall. And one of the lads was about to go up and over. And I said, keep down. They want you to do that. You just stay put for a couple of hours. Anyway, it wasn't a couple of hours, perhaps about half an hour. And we made use of the ladder, all right. But I had to go first. And when I looked over the wall, there were the grapevines. There was a dead German officer with a bullet through his temple. He must have been shot by one of either the sergeant or, you know, one of our party. And we made a dash for the grapevines, crawled along. A big bunch of grapes, they were ready for harvesting. And my heart was pounding, terrified. We had to get back and report. And of course, a voice from the rear said, oh, this is a life, this isn't it, Les. And I couldn't believe it. One of our friends was lying on his back. He had the biggest bunch of grapes, you could say. You couldn't help but laugh at him. He had this big bunch of grapes over his mouth. He said, this is the life for me. Bring on the girls. And then suddenly, as he opened his mouth, all the earwigs fell from the bunch of grapes. So, he paid for his mistake of clowning around. Anyway, we did eventually get back. There's five of us, of our party, and they volunteered me, being the oldest soldier, to take them back. So I said, well, if I'm to take you back, I want that machine gun. It gave you that little bit of extra confidence to a rifle. It's Bren gun. We did get back, reported to the officer, and I got told off for not searching the officer, the dead body. And I said, well, the reason why I didn't search him, sir, I thought he may be booby-trapped. And I was just being cautious. So after that, well, it was a case of, as we progressed, you know, meeting patrols and skirmishes, we finally came to the mountain areas. And that's where I I quoted, we'd been on this one hill. You see, what was happening then? If it was light resistance, it was a company attack. It would face, well, it'd be a bigger battalion attack, like that, you say. And, of course, there was one prisoner. I was with this one lad that we had there, Brengon, and this figure loomed up out of the darkness, and I thought, he's German, all right. And he was a paratrooper, just been dropped. Looked as though he'd just been dropped. He had all the gear on. And I searched him. I said to him, chap that was with me, keep him covered with that machine gun, but make sure I'm out the way if he makes a move, because I don't want to go yet. So I was searching his body, and I knew he had a knife somewhere, the paratroopers, but I couldn't find the pocket, as it was over his left shoulder. He put his hand over and pulled it out, and it was a flick knife. Marvellous knife, and I kept it as a souvenir. But unfortunately, that souvenir ended up at the bottom of the sea with my kit bag, so I never saw that again. after that, I got wounded, 22nd of September, 1944.
How did it happen?
I'd been on patrol. You see, you've got a series of mountains, some higher than others, like a stepping stone. It's a ridge of mountains. I forget the name of them now. And I'd been on patrol. We got back, we'd been attacked, and we were to observe the strength of the enemy and then get back. Got back, 5 o'clock, I think it was. Yes, 5 o'clock. And at 5:30, the order was given, fix bayonets. I'd gone about, perhaps 50 yards. All of a sudden, the machine gun opened up. And it cut down, I was in the leading section, and it cut the front section. We all got, most of them were killed, I believe. I moved my hand, because it seemed as though I was going up about 20 foot, when in actual fact, I should imagine, it's just that my legs were knocked from underneath me. But it felt like I'd gone tremendous height, and when I hit the rock, it was hard ground, like granite, and that shook every bone in my body. And I searched across and moved my hand, trying to stop the bleeding, because it was the sensation. I know now, it was the nerves going out of my body, because it had damaged the sciatic nerve and paralysed me. So I couldn't move my legs. So I moved my hand, and there was a burst of machine gun fire, and it landed just by my body, just missed me. And it was so close that the bits of granite hit me face and stung me face. And I thought, well, you know, I've had it. And I'm sure I heard a voice say, shut up. Of course, I was screaming, you know, the pain and that. And I was worried about my rifle, where that had got to. Because that was your best friend. Really was your best friend. And, of course, whether it's fact or fiction, I don't know. But I kept going unconscious and then coming round. Somebody kicked my body. And I just had a sense that they were bayoneting. And anyway, I believe it was a couple of days later that there was two Sikhs. They carried me down the mountain.
You mean you were just lying out on the battlefield?
Yeah, yes. And it seemed like, you know, days upon days, but just looking up at the sky, you know, just pretending I was dead, you know. So, anyway, I seem to recall I had a drink off someone. I think it was an officer, because he had a, it was one of those flasks, and it was brandy or something like that. And then somebody gave me an injection, and that eased the pain a bit. But these two Sikhs, they were the stretcher bearers, they carried me down the mountain, and every time a shell came across, they dropped the stretcher and covered my body. So, and it took them awful long time to get down. And I seem to remember, I thought that day before, or when we were up there, I saw a jeep on the road down below. And I'm putting the stretcher on the jeep, and all of a sudden there was a puff of smoke and the jeep disappeared with the wounded man and the driver, paramedic. They didn't call them paramedics then. So, you know, it was a bit worrying. But eventually they got me to this field. It was a tent in a field, a huge tent. And they had me on the floor, and they put a cover over my eyes. And just as the cover came off my eyes, and I looked up, and I just saw the surgeon just cutting the man open to get shrapnel out. And I thought, oh dear me, what's happening here? And he finished with that one. They put me up, and he said, I want the living, not the dead. He's finished. So that saved my life. That was another occasion. I've been spared all the way along, because he did me a favour, that chap. Because by saying that, that gave me courage to say, I'm not going to die here. I'm going to get out of this. And later on, when I did come round after being treated in this hospital, I thought it was a prisoner of war, because there were all Germans in there. They were all Germans. And until they fetched one chap from our unit, and he was opposite me, and unfortunately he died. So it was pretty horrifying, you know. But I was meant to survive. So there was the incident going across by the scare about the U-boats. And
going across from
England, from the Clyde to Italy. So there's several times. And then on, they patched me up there. And the nurses there, they were really marvellous. They were the Canadian nurses.
Where was this?
This was it was near where I'd been wounded, must have been. San Lorenzo, something like that, I can't remember. And they were very good. You know, I was a bit embarrassed being a young lad, of a nurse having to clean me backside. And she reassured me, she said, this is my job, to look after you. Anyway, they flew me from in the Dakota. I don't know whether you've seen the Dakota.
Yes.
They were the workhorse of the Americans. And they'd rigged this, fix the stretcher in some device. And I was near this little window. No, just me, and there was a pilot and one of his crew. And I was covered in plaster from head to foot, you know, with the paralysis. And I said, where's my parachute? He said, even the bloody pilot hasn't got a parachute. He said, anyway, with what you've got on your body, you'll sink like a bloody stone. So there you go. So I finally arrived at Naples. I was in the 64th British General Hospital in Naples. And while I was there, I was very pleasantly surprised to see my brother. He'd been transferred from the Dorsetshires to the artillery. And he was on the Bofa guns for shooting the planes down. I believe he went across on a corvette, just a small boat. And I think he landed at Salerno. And I didn't know this. And the doors open, and I was very ill. And he walked in. Well, you can imagine. You know, tears of joy when he walked in. So he did me the world of good. And what pleased me so much was the fact that his battery, his gun battery, because he was a bombardier, he said, we've had a collection. Now, they didn't know me, never met me. And this is the comradeship. They brought me cigarettes, because I did smoke in those days. Cigarettes, chocolate. Well, if you got, you could get chocolate, you got it off the Americans. They had it. And, you know, writing paper and things like that. I mean, in the past, I wrote letters to on toilet paper, if you could get hold of toilet paper. You know? So, I was there for a few weeks, and then they sent me back on the HMS Dorchester. Funnily enough, I trained at Dorchester, but the hospital ship was the HMS Dorchester, and that was attacked as we went through the Mediterranean. You know, a big the cross on the side of the ship, but, you know, some of the U-boat commanders, they didn't care. So, but fortunately, it was a scare, and that was it. I mean, there was no torpedoes fired, else I wouldn't be here today, if there had been, but we heard about it. And, of course, I always remember on that ship, they put me in the bum-uppy, what we call the bum-uppy crowd. They put me in a cot. I wasn't allowed knives and forks or anything like that. And I said, what am I doing here? I said, I know I'm mad, but I'm not that mad. Get me out of here. Of course, they were all screaming and, you know, fighting amongst one another. Anyway, they got me out of that. So, see, I had to survive, and I got back to the Clyde. I had a spell in Killearn Hospital near Glasgow. And it was near Christmas time, and they all had a drink. Of course, the whiskey drink is up there. Bearing in mind, I was down to 6.5 stone from 11.5. And I was very, very weak. Couldn't walk. And they gave me a drink of whiskey. And I was drunk, wasn't I? With having that whiskey. But that deadened the pain. And they said, we're going to send you by Red Cross train down to your home. My father came to pick me up. I didn't know this. He walked into the ward. And he said, I've come to pick my son up. He said, oh, he's gone by the Red Cross in the morning. I said, I'm sorry, I can't wait that long. I'm taking him home. And he picked me up. Oh, they found me some clothes. And I must have looked a sorry sight. A blanket. He put me over his shoulder. And he carried me to the station. But before he got to the station, he stopped at this vicarage. Now, my father liked a pint. He liked any drink, because he was a hard-working man. And, you know, he loved his beer. It knocked on his door. The vicar came to the door. He said, oh, my son is he just come back from the war, and I'm taking him home. Can you find a drink? And I've just got wine. Oh, that'll do. He brought it to the door. My father took the glass off him, drank it, and he said, I feel much better now. Thank you very much. So Leslie didn't get a drink. It was just an excuse for my dad to get a drink. So this is one of the funny things of war, you know. Anyway, he did get me home. And as we were going around we lived at Hornwall Road, Lee Hall, Birmingham. And as we went round this corner, my dad propped me up against the low fence. And he said, just stay there, don't fall over, I'll come back for you. He ran to the house, and my younger brothers and my oldest brother, he couldn't go to the war because he had bad nerves and he wasn't accepted. They wouldn't take him. And they had the biggest flag I've seen in my life across the house. You know, welcome home. So I got in and sat down. My two younger brothers, Norman, who was to go into the Navy submarines later, and my other younger brother, who was a sergeant in the Black Watch later, they stood and just looked at me, and I said, well, don't join up. And I just dropped my trousers, and I said, there's my wounds. Just think twice before you go to battle. I said, it's all right when you're in this country. I said, I had it hard in the Shetland Islands, wishing I was away from there. I said, no, Sandra, I got in the front line. 10 minutes in the front line, that was enough for me. I said, but I was no hero. I just did as I was told and did my duty. And for that, well, you know, I got back. So I'm one of the fortunate ones that got back from the war. One of the youngest, because I'm 76. Most of the boys are in the 80s now. So I was very lucky. But it was a boost to me to see my brother in Italy. He, you know, really cheered me up.
What was the progress of your recovery from wounds back in England?
Such a lot. I was in 3 hospitals in the Midlands. One was called the Woodlands Royal Cripples Hospital, where they drew maps on my legs, stuck pins in to find out where the sensations were, and photographed it so that they could give me the necessary treatment. Fortunately, the use came back in the right side, so the sciatic nerve was damaged, but the left side, well, that's persisted over the years. So I spent, I'd met a girl, going back to my story, I'd met a girl when I was in Durham, and I might as well tell you the full story. There was this Scotch lad, he said to me, we called him Jock, naturally. He said, come on, Les. Want to go outside for a walk? I said, oh, I may as well. So I said, come on, we'll go outside. We'll pick up a couple of bits of stuff. That was his exact words. So we were walking along to Dryburn Hospital in Durham from North Road, where we stationed. It was an old picture house. And, of course, there was these two lasses. And I said, I'll have the little one on the right. So I met her, and the next day I saw her out with another lad, and she came and apologised. And she said, I'll write to you. So she wrote to me, and I wrote quite a lot of letters when I could. And she said, when I came back, I said, oh, don't bother with me. Get someone that's fit and well. Get yourself another boy. And she came down on the next train to Birmingham, and that was it. When I got stronger and I discharged from hospital and the army, we decided to get married. And she said, she worked in a hospital, you see. She said, I'll look after you. So that picture that I had when I got wounded, it was always in my back pocket, and that gave me the will to live, because you think of your girlfriend, you think of your family, and so I had that in mind all the way through. And we got married at the little village called Pittington, which is near Durham. I was in the hospital such a lot. In Dunstan Hill Hospital, it was a military hospital, and I had various operations. I think it was 25 operations, and I was a regular customer there. But they were real kind to us, the people of Tyneside and Gateshead. They used to come to the hospital and say, oh, we're going to we want a party of soldiers or Air Force lads or Navy chaps, six of you, pick two from each lot, you see, take you to a party. It might be a 21st. I once went to an invitation to a Jewish wedding, which I had a wonderful time. And 21st, somewhere, a lot of drinks. Well, I couldn't take a lot of drink because I managed to get out on crutches to these various functions. But they were ever so kind, the people of Tyneside. I think my longest spell was around about 6 months in Dunton Hill. Of course, I had not only the wounds, I had the my toes were paralysed, so they went under. And I was walking on the knuckles of my toes, and that caused calluses. My big toe developed a bunion. They're in plaster for about 3 months, something like that. And then at the finish, I had gangrene set in, and they wanted to take my leg off. And I said, no, I'll keep my leg. And I got it today. I've got no toes, but I can still get about. I've got my wheelchair and my car, and I'm grateful for small mercies, so.
And when you served in the North South, which platoon and company did you serve in?
A Company, I think it was. A Company. There was so many, platoons you moved about, I think it was on parade, because I used to be always shouted, on parade A Company. Pretty sure it was A Company. At Anzio, you didn't know which company or which platoon you were in, because you were in the thick of it, But what I remember mostly about the war was the horror of the shells, the sound of the shells. And the funniest incident, which I failed to tell you, was three men trying to get into a two-man slit trench, and I was the one in the middle. So that there were just the heads in the slit trench. So if the shell had landed nearby,